And thank you for giving me this opportunity again. It's so meaningful to me. My office was right next to Rabbi Dr. Feuerman's. And over the years, we had a chance to often compare notes and schmooze and talk. And I learned such an incredible amount from him that I find myself almost on a daily basis quoting from his wisdom. I contacted members of the Feuerman family, children, grandchildren, and the people who knew him best and he was closest to. And we started a series of texts where I asked them where they saw the optimism in his life, where they saw the hope in his life. And again, I learned a whole bunch of other deeper insights into what he was all about. Let me start with optimism. And I'll start with the basic observation that anybody who knew him well, or anybody who just had any contact with him, realized pretty quickly that this was not a man filled with anxiety. This was a man who had a firm sense of himself in the world, a firm sense of bitachon and emuna, and a belief that as long as you do your hishtadlus, as long as you do what your part is, the rest is in God's hands. And I'll play off that a little bit. I'll start with a beautiful quote from that the whole family shared, Rabbi Simcha Feuerman shared also, and I remember this from the Hespedim at the funeral. He said that when Rabbi Feuerman was run over in 1980, it was in a terrible accident where he was basically run over and his life was bleeding out of him. This is a direct quote from Simcha. His first thought was to say Shema, basically to give in to the fact that these were the last breaths that he was going to take. But then he said to himself, who said I was going to die? You know, who said I have to give in to this? Instead, what ran through like a mantra in his mind is he said to himself, the pasuk that we see every morning from Adon Olam, Yado afkid ruchi. My spirit and my life is in his hands. And it's that core belief and core optimism that I think is at the center of this component of what we're focusing on today. Because I think we can learn a tremendous amount, especially in an age of pessimism and negativity and complaining, and where it's all too simple for people to be critical of each other and to literally live in a world of pessimism and anger, his life and his memory is an antidote. I'm often reminded, and this is something that I did discuss with Rabbi Feuerman a number of times, is the ultimate lesson in optimism that we're going to be reading about in the parshios to come as we move towards the story of Yosef and his brothers. And there's this beautiful imagery that I just love thinking about because it's such a contrast. It's the story of Yosef and his brothers bringing their father to his burial at the end of his life and following his wishes burying Yaakov. And you can imagine what's going through the brother's mind at that point. Some of the psukim actually say, literally, what's going through their minds must be, okay, now that he doesn't have to worry, now that they don't have to worry about the anger or disapproval of Yaakov, this is the second most powerful man in the world. He could easily end our lives. So what does he do? It's the first words out of his mouth after the burial. He looks at his brothers. Again, the second most powerful man in the world. And he says, let's go visit the pit. Let's go visit the pit that you threw me in. You can only imagine the terror and the certainty running through their minds as they together with Yosef's entourage go to the pit. And he looks into the pit. And as the Medrash tells us, what does he do? He says the following words. He says, Baruch she'asa li nes b'makom hazeh. He thanks God for the miracle that he performed for him in this place. He so easily could have chosen to go in a whole other direction. He so easily could have thrown them into the pit to terrify them the way they abandoned him to his almost certain death when many years earlier. And instead, he chose to focus on the positive. He chose to focus on forgiveness, which I find is an amazing thing to say. You know, I'm reminded of a story of just sort of the power of this bracha. I have a niece who was in Eretz Yisrael during the height of the Second Intifada. And she was in the neighborhood of Nachlat Sheva when there was a horrible terror attack. And an aunt who she was with threw herself on top of her to protect her. But there was a soldier by the name of Mayan, a woman who totally selflessly threw herself on them and took the bullets for them and was unfortunately killed. So Mayan was killed. A number of years later, when this niece got married and had her first child was a girl, and she called her Mayan in honor and in memory of a woman who in a sense gave her life back. And I was once walking with her and the family in that area. And I heard her sort of saying something, some tefillah to herself. I said, what are you saying? And she said, every time I pass by this place, I say, Baruch she'asa li nes b'makom hazeh. But then she has her first child, names her Mayan, and brings her as soon as she can to visit Mayan, Zichrona Lebracha's parents. And she introduces the baby Mayan to the parents. And they developed a relationship. And to me, I'm so amazed at the power of not just of the gratitude, but the power of being able to take something so tragic and life-transforming and to be able to use the that core lesson in such a powerful, powerful kind of way. She celebrates that day that she was saved almost like a yontif. And it's bittersweet, but it's also at the core of the kind of optimism that we often see and saw in the life of Rabbi Dr. Feuerman. When I spoke to the family members, there was a consistent theme of saying that Dr. Foreman's optimism was a realistic optimism. It wasn't just being a Pollyanna where you see the positives in everything and, you know, never, ever looking at things realistically. Listen to this research. Research finds that the downside of optimism is that basically is that optimists are more likely than pessimists to keep on gambling after losing money. It's thought at times to be a contributing factor in the research to car accidents because of having an overly positive view of one's driving ability. Most people in the United States consider themselves to be far better than average as drivers. Optimists tend to totally unrealistically overrate their own abilities. They play down the probability of a disaster, which can lead them astray in other situations where assessing risk accurately is vital, like choosing a profession or selecting a mate. Obviously, thank God, not in this situation. But that's what I kept hearing over and over again from the family, is that it was an optimism and a positivity tempered with realism. Now, in contrast, let's talk about the clear benefits of optimism. Even though many of us know this, or most of us know it, it's worth reviewing, okay? Here's one thing. In a journal on Leadership Quarterly, they find that a positive, happy leader is judged to be 132% more effective than a dour, negative one. There's a classic study that's often quoted in the field of positive psychology by Dr. Martin Seligman. Dr. Martin Seligman, who's at the University of Pennsylvania and the founder of positive psychology, he did a study of the speech given at the nominating convention of every president from 1900 on. And he stripped it of identifiers, and he had his graduate students not knowing who was giving the speech, a Democrat or Republican. He had them rate the speech for number of positive and optimistic comments versus pessimistic comments. And as we won't be surprised to hear, it turned out that the level of optimism in the speech given at the nominating conventions was a far better predictor of who would win the election than any poll was. Far more accurate than polls. Okay, so that's something an important lesson that's very current today. And that's what Rabbi Dr. Korman was about. His realism was tempered by a deep belief in the importance of focusing what one has control over. Let me talk a little bit now about the power of hope, which I find to be so incredibly important, especially at a time like this. You know, we're smack in the middle of the pandemic. It's trying times. It's trying times where we're living in the fog, living with uncertainty. You know, I asked the Feuerman children and grandchildren, and I think in some cases even great-grandchildren, to tell me how they think their father would have handled the pandemic. And what I heard over and over again is he wouldn't have, he very similar to what I've seen in people of that generation, is he wouldn't have sweated over the politics. He wouldn't have chosen a side one way or another. He would have said, Hakol Biyad Hashem. He said, everything is in God's hands. And he would have focused on, again, on his own sense and belief in good coming. You know, there's a often quoted medrash from Vayechi on the pasuk Lishuasa Kivisi Hashem. in the middle of the brachos that Yaakov gives to his sons. And in the Bereishis Rabbah, which has been brought down by many, especially Rabbi Dr. David Fox, has been speaking a lot about the wisdom of this Medrash, which is an amazing Medrash. The Medrash says, Hakol b'kivui, everything is dealt with hope. But basically, we need to meet the trials and tribulations of our lives with hope, with tikva. Then it goes on to say, Yisurim, going through tough times. You know, Rabbi Feuerman experienced chronic pain. Nobody really knows how intense the pain was. From what I understand and from what I saw at times, although he never really showed it, he was in a lot of pain ever since that 1980 accident. Yisurim b'kivui, we have to deal with hope. Geula, our ultimate redemption, comes b'kivui. It comes with hope. Chanina and slicha and forgiveness comes with kivui. You know, Rabbi Feuerman never stayed angry at anybody. I never heard him. Sure, he'd hold his students to a high standard, and sure, he could be appropriately critical of them when they didn't meet the standard that he thought that they were capable of, but it was never mixed with any personal disapproval or disappointment. It was always mixed with basically the hope and the slicha and the wisdom that comes with tikva. You know, the Hebrew word tikva is tied to the word kav, a rope. It's tied to the fact that we're never alone dangling. And it's the power of connection. Let me develop this a little bit more. There's been some research recently about what goes into mentorship. And I think, and I'd argue, that part of the power of Rabbi Feuerman came from his gift at being able to be an incredibly effective mentor. And I'll review with you some of the recent research that's shared by Dr. Anthony Tijan. It goes like this. Number one, put the relationship before the mentorship, okay? He says all too often mentorship can evolve into just a check-the-box procedure instead of being something authentic. In order for mentorship to be truly effective, you need authenticity. You need somebody who's toko kuboro, who's literally the same inside and outside. And everybody who knew Rabbi Feuerman knew that that was at his core. This was a truly, truly authentic man, and boy, we need him in this age of inauthenticity. He goes on to say, and to quote research, actually, done by Dr. Reagans, who's a mentoring expert at the University of Wisconsin. And she found that unless proteges have a basic relationship with their mentors, like a core relationship, then the research shows there's no discernible difference between mentees and those not mentored. All this is to say that mentoring requires rapport. So there's that. Let me quote to you some of the thoughts of Rabbi Sacks. You know, as I was preparing for this and reading about it, I had the privilege of having known Rabbi Sacks, not nearly as well as I would like to have known him. But he did invite me, and his office had invited me a number of times to be the visiting scholar at the conference they had every few years in the UK. And he would sit in front of me as I was giving talks, and then he'd give me 3 lists of feedback on whatever it was I said. Books that I had to read, books that are extremely essential, but it's okay for me to wait maybe a few weeks till I have a little more time. And then another list that basically I just had to think about if I was going to be able to develop my skills in a way that he was mentoring me to do. I'm going to just read to you some of his thoughts on hope and morality. Because in the last book he wrote called Morality, Rabbi Sacks said some unbelievable kinds of insights. Let me start by sharing with you a quote. It's at the end of his book, and it's the last book he wrote. He wrote it recently enough that it weaves into it the lessons of the pandemic. So one of the things he says is that in a survey of moral attitudes in 60 cultures around the world, they found 7 basic moral rules that each culture that valued morality had in common. And he says these are core. It's sort of built into us, built into our humanity. And it's everybody believing. And as I was reading it, I was thinking of, boy, is this ever relevant to a program honoring the life of Rabbi Dr. Feuerman? Here are the 7 basic moral rules. Help your family. Help your group. Return favors. You know, take without giving back. Be brave. Listen to your superiors. Divide resources fairly. Be honest, right? Respect other people's properties. Listen to this quote where Rabbi Sacks, in a series of interviews he did with leaders in the world on morality and ethics, both in the Jewish world and in the secular world. So Rabbi Sacks quotes Melinda Gates, who he interviewed and asked her, what message would you give for adolescents and young adults today? What do you want them to have sort of as their bumper stickers? And here's what Melinda Gates answered. Okay, her message to the youth of today. What I want to tell you is that when you look out over the arc of your life and what you want to do with your life and what you want it to stand for, the things that you're going to feel best about in life is that you were loved by your family and friends and that you have done something to change the world for the better in some way. If you start now, even in small ways, by little drops in the bucket, you will be amazed at how much that adds up to over the course of a lifetime. And that's what Rabbi Sacks kind of ends the last book that I believe was ever published in his lifetime. You know, the image that kept running through my mind as I was reading Rabbi Sacks' writings about hope and optimism was that it's all about the key to mentorship that we started to talk about. And there's a classic book written by Dr. Jean Rhodes at Harvard University. And she wrote a book that's like the classic review on what makes for a great mentor. And she called the book Stand By Me. Because what she found was that it isn't the content of what a mentor does. It isn't the facts that he or she imparts. It's basically the feeling they leave you with. the feeling of an authentic I-thou relationship, the feeling of somebody who really cares about you and stands by you. And I'm left with the beautiful thoughts of Rabbeinu Tzadok, which I quoted to some of you before, which I think is at the essence of this aspect of Rabbi Feuerman. Kishem shet sarach adam Muhammad v'Hashem yisbarach. Just like we have to believe in God, kach sarach achar kach l'ha'amin ba'atzma. So too do we need to believe in ourselves. Rosh Lomar, sheyesh l'HaKadosh Baruch Hu esek imo. Hashem cares about us. She'enenu po'el batel. She'bein layla hayo, bein layla avad. We're not an insignificant being, here one day and gone the next. That's the essence of the kind of life that Rabbi Dr. Feuerman lived. And I just want to share with you, before we open this up to comments, because I thought it would be helpful to just get some input from members of the family and from the Talmidim and Talmidos who, Rabbi Feuerman impacted so amazingly. I just want to share with you what happened just this Thursday. This Thursday, we had a doctoral defense of Rabbi Dr. Eli Melech Gawi, who is a long-standing Talmud of Rabbi Dr. Feuerman. He was on his doctoral committee. He had been a principal in a number of schools, in Hafter and Hank and in other places, and is a very respected mentor to many, many educators. And after many years of trying, Rabbi Dr. Gottlieb handed in a magnificent dissertation. And in the defense, Rabbi Feuerman was there in the room with us. He had, until his Pentira, been a member of the committee shaping this study. But also, there's a ritual that has lived on, and I have a feeling, and I hope will continue to live on, that now is part of every Azrieli doctoral dissertation. At the end of the defense, there's the person who's defending the dissertation goes out. We discuss whether or not it should pass or not pass, how it should pass, different kinds of revisions. But at the end of the defense, if a person finally, after all these years of work, passes the defense, Rabbi Dr. Sokolow turns to the student, and the first thing that he does, he says, I'll tell you what Rabbi Dr. Feuerman said at the end of every defense. This is as we're opening up a bottle of champagne to toast the tremendous achievement. He says, welcome to the community of scholars. Welcome to the community of scholars. And at this defense, the spirit of Rabbi Dr. Feuerman, you know, even though it's been some time after his patira, it was in the room. It was in the room. There wasn't a dry eye in the room. And that's how he lives on. That's how he lives on. And will continue to live on. He's part of the DNA of our school and of our school, which is minting the new generation of Jewish leaders and Jewish educators. So with that image, I'd love to hear some thoughts or comments. Dr. Novick is going to monitor the chat and share with us comments people have, or else people could just unmute themselves and weigh in. We have to keep with Dr. Foreman's precision. We have 12 minutes.
There are as yet no questions in the chat room, Dr. Polkovitz, but people should feel free to either make a comment or leave a question in the chat room, or as Dr. Polkovitz suggested, just open your mic and share something.
The one thing I didn't talk about, by the way, is the family weighed in on how he would have handled this pandemic. And a number of people were asking, would he have been able to master Zoom? After all, he was an older man. And I forgot to tell the family that he really worked on mastering the computer, right? I forget who it was. I think it was Eliezer Barony, you know, part of the staff at Mount Azrieli, worked with him, and he threw himself into mastering. He would have been far better at Zoom than I am. That would be my prediction. And the family shared a bunch of other things. Who wants to share with us a little bit here?
There's a question, wasn't Rabbi Foreman also active in Nefesh?
Yes, he was. He was active in Nefesh. He was very generous in mentoring mental health professionals. He had training as an analyst. And most importantly, his son, Simcha, Rabbi Simcha Foreman, was very, you know, very much, you know, one of the founding leaders of Nefesh for years. And the family in general has is very much part of Nefesh International's leadership and interface of mental health and halacha.
Rabbi Tuckman is with us, who is a very clear Talmud of Dr. Foreman, as well as an Azrieli graduate. You want to share some thoughts, Rabbi Tuckman?
I have. It's a huge honor to speak in certainly in the illustrious company of Dr. Polkovitz and Kalinsky and all the others gathered here, but to speak in honor of our Rebbe, Rabbi Foreman, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, is an honor above all. I have no doubt whatsoever that Rabbi Foreman would be teaching all of us how to use Zoom. Not even the slightest doubt. I can very clearly imagine him sitting in his sitting at home in his office, but instead of his phone number, which he constantly talked to people. Remember, this is somebody who was doing conference calls when people weren't doing conference calls, and who had a cell phone when people didn't have cell phones. I have very little doubt of that there would be many, myself included, who would have regular Zoom meetings with him, and that he would be giving class by Zoom with no problem. There are days that I can't believe that I can't just pick up the phone and call my fireman. And then there are days that I don't need to, because he's right there next to me. You know, when we talk about handling the pandemic, as I think Dr. Polkovitz said, Rabbi Foreman always faced everything that came to him, and taught us all to face everything that came to us as a new challenge in a new way. I think Rabbi Foreman probably reinvented himself before the idea of reinventing yourself came about, multiple times in his life. The idea that a new challenge would be anything unusual for him is I think it would be something that he would embrace with the twinkle of, okay, here's a new way to do it. What can I learn about this? What interesting things can I learn about myself and about humanity by the way we interact on Zoom? You know, he's certainly very sorely missed. And I know that all of us try our best to emulate what he brought to our students, and to his students rather, to us, when we are working with our students and their students. And it's certainly true what Dr. Novick said in the introduction. Even anybody who doesn't know that they were a student of Rabbi Foreman, it's simply that they just don't know. because I doubt very much that there is an educator in the United States and probably in most other countries in the world who is not, who did not learn something directly from Rabbi Feuerman or from a student of Rabbi Feuerman, or at this point in time, a student of a student of Rabbi Feuerman. Because I think there are probably fourth or fifth generation teachers of his, students of his teaching Klal Yisrael at this point.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Tuchman. We have a volunteer, Mark Seidenfeld, to share something. Mark?
Sure, thank you. Many people know me as Moshe. It's just my Zoom is
Mark. Your Zoom address, Moshe.
I'm Rabbi Feuerman's grandson, and I lived with him for some time, just me and him, in his home for a few years. And I have always on the top of my head many, many stories, but I'll keep it to two. And the first one is just a cute story of the lighter side of his life. I spent a lot of time watching movies with him because whenever he went to sleep, he would habitually like to have noise in the background, which dated back to when he was in the hospital after his 1980 accident. The nurse would put Fiddler on the Roof on repeat on the radio. And he was in the hospital for months and months and months, and then bedridden at home for months and months and months. So he became used to having noise in the room. So that's why many times he liked having the TV and falling asleep with the TV on in the background. So whenever I'd sometimes just go upstairs, I lived downstairs to hang out with him at night. Many times what would be on was Turner Classic Movies. And I don't know if any of you may know this about him, but without hesitation, he would be able to name every single actress and actor in every single one of those movies, always, every single time. And it was very funny. And he knew them backwards and forwards. We watched them all together and he would give commentary on them. And it was very fun watching. We watched also a lot of the, traditionally Jewish immigration movies like Hester Street and then Crossing Delancey we watched, and he would really give commentary on it as if it was like a Blu-ray edition on a DVD. And he would always want to, it would be very difficult for him to miss a class. So usually his aide would drive him. But there was this one time I was getting ready to leave the home, and I see him sitting in his wheelchair by the front door with the front door open, and he's just sitting all dressed and ready to go. And I'm like, Zadie, what are you doing? And he said, I'm waiting for my Uber. He ordered an Uber to get to class that day. And I thought it was very funny. And he was trying to figure out how to use Uber, and he did. He figured it out on his own. And that's a little bit more about the lighter, side of his life. And then a great story with he very much respected and liked Rav Moshe Feinstein, and he had great personal stories with him. So one of them was, at the time he was in some higher up role. I may be botching the story. If I do, maybe my uncle Simcha might be able to clarify some truths. But he was somewhere in an administrative role or some kind of big role in Torah Masorah at the time. And there was a big convention, which they do like once a year or so, where everybody involved in Chinuch, it would be a big deal. They'd come, and one of the biggest attractions was the panel of the Gedolim of the time. So they were inviting Rav Moshe Feinstein to come. And when they do, he said that it wasn't like you just got an invitation in the mail. There'd be like a delegation that would come to your home to invite you, even though you knew there was an invitation coming. It would just be a respectful thing to do. So they were Rabbi Feuerman and whoever was going with him to the delegation went to Rav Moshe Feinstein's house, and they sat with him. And he said Rav Moshe Feinstein was always writing, like he's always writing something, writing tshuvas, writing whatever it is that he's writing. And they came into the home and he's writing. And then he looks up and they sit with him, and they're talking to him about, the Torah Masorah convention, this And it's like a big deal. It's like the Torah Masorah Convention. It's the everyone nationally who's involved in chinuch is going to come, and they're going to see what are the big things going on. This is a big deal. The big things going on in chinuch, it's massive. It's very, very important. And they're in the middle of speaking with him, and then Rav Moshe Feinstein's wife comes to the office and says something to Rav Moshe Feinstein, and then goes up to or says she's going to take a nap. And Zadie said, okay, whatever. She said she was going to take a nap. We didn't really take much meaning to it. And then we continued talking about the super important chinuch world and Torah Masorah stuff that we were talking about. And then there was a knock at the door a few minutes later, or the doorbell rang, one of those two. And Moshe Feinstein is trying to like get up. And then Zadie, Rabbi Feuerman, along with who was with him, said, like, don't worry, like, we'll go get it. It's okay. Because in their mind, they're talking about something really important, A, and then B, he doesn't have to go get up to get the door, they'll get the door. And like, I'll go get it. And then they couldn't keep Moshe Feinstein from getting up to go get the door. And as much as they were trying to say, it's okay, like, we'll go get the door. And Rav Moshe Feinstein eventually fought his way through, got up, and went to the door. And it was a Puerto Rican boy delivering eggs. And Rav Moshe Feinstein tipped him. And this was a big, small moment, but it was a massive paradigm shift for Zadie, because in his mind, he said they were talking about, like, the most important thing ever. They're talking about the world of chinuch, and they're going to have this panel of gedolim, and everybody's going to be there, and they're talking about the big problems nationally facing them. But the big thing on his mind was tipping the Puerto Rican boy for delivering the eggs. And that, amongst a few other things, kind of shifted him to be more of the person who we all know him to be at this time. You know, those were the two stories I wanted to share.
Thank you.